case set for argument this afternoon, people concerning SM and SRG. Before we get started with discussions, I want to just point out that this is the first oral argument in this courtroom, and we are pleased that you are able to participate in it. Thank you very much for coming all the distance that you did to do so. I also would like to note that we got a phone call from Susan Baker indicating she was stuck on Monument Hill, and consequently she informed our clerk's office she would not be attending, but she indicated her consent was available and she wanted you to go ahead. So we're going to go ahead and hear the argument without her presence. You may have argued before us before. Let me simply briefly review the ground rules. The case is set for 15 minutes per side. The appellant may reserve whatever part of the 15 minutes you wish for rebuttal. You'll be guided by a lighting system which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light on the podium will come on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light will come on. And when the full 15 minutes have expired, the red light will come on. The clock counts backwards from 15, so you will know how much time you have left by looking at the clock there on the podium. We've read the briefs. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth. So to the extent you wish to dispense with the discussion of the facts and go directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us, but the case is yours to argue as you wish. Finally, we are recording the arguments today. We sometimes go back and listen to them again if we have issues that we need clarification about. So please stay close to the microphone, otherwise your voice will not be picked up well. Also be aware that the arguments are available over the internet within a day or two after today. So if there's any confidential information, obviously parties' names in this case, we don't want to have you mentioned, but if there's any other confidential information, you should be guided accordingly, knowing that it's going to be accessible. All right, we're ready for you.
Ian Hotson-Piller for respondent appellant SM Senior. May it please the court, counsel. One aspect of this case is clear and convincing. One aspect is clear and convincing, and that is that there was a viable, less drastic alternative that to termination of father's parental rights that was improperly rejected by the district court. In this particular and somewhat unique case, that alternative was already in place at the time of the termination hearing. It had been tested, and it was working. The child in this case had been placed with the family of the first cousin of the father at father's request only a few months after his birth. And the undisputed evidence, overwhelming evidence, is that the child was thriving in that home was safe, it was secure, it was stable, and very likely going to be a permanent home for that child. That was the circumstance. Nobody challenged that circumstance. Everybody agreed that this was a safe, stable, likely permanent home for this child.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Hotson-Piller, if I can. I think there's no dispute here that the standard is that the court has to consider less drastic alternatives. You agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. In this case, I'll give your colleagues a heads up here, I'm going to have a little bit of concern that the court started with the premise that the statute expressed a preference for adoption, which I have some concern about. But barring that, why do you say the court here didn't consider the less drastic alternative? The court, I think, did look at that and was concerned about whether someone somewhere down the road can make another motion and reopen things and may affect the permanency. It seems like there's some basis for saying the court considered and rejected the less drastic alternative. It certainly didn't ignore it. What do you think?
Okay. First, Your Honor, I do not agree that this court, that the extent of this court's review is just did the district court consider the less drastic alternative? Because, in fact, this court should only affirm the ruling if the court considered it and its decision is supported by a record. So I don't agree that it's sufficient to just say the district court considered the matter. I think this reviewing panel has to go further than that. And the problem we have here is that the district court employed really errors in logic. And what happened here is the district court said essentially, I'm rejecting the less drastic alternative because it's less drastic. A tautological mistake. I'm rejecting the less drastic alternative because the, quote, quality of permanence is not the same as a termination of parental rights. Well, of course, always the less drastic alternative is of a different quality of permanence. That's why our courts have been very clear in charging district courts with the duty to not only consider, but adopt appropriate, less drastic alternatives. So it doesn't help us at all for, you know, to simply say, well, it's a less drastic alternative and the quality of permanence isn't the same. That's a good enough reason. And I don't think that that ruling should be allowed to stand because otherwise we can reject less drastic alternatives whenever we want to without a real basis. Your Honor, I think to really focus on your question, I read the cases and from this court that distinguish when it is appropriate to reject a less drastic alternative. And what they talk about is you do that if it is necessary. If that is what is necessary to secure a stable, permanent home for the child. And I think that's the fundamental question that should have been asked by the district court. And I think that's the question that has to be asked by this court. And unless that question is asked, the determination is supported by evidence in the record, the order in this case should be rejected and has to be vacated. So I hope I responded to your...
You did, Mr. Otzenfield. Let me follow up, though.
Yes.
In what you, I understand what you were just saying, but why address, if you would, specifically the court's findings that or expressions of concern that, you know, 5 years from now, dad may show up and change his mind. And the court said, you know, adoption is going to be more difficult to reopen. And the court was clearly concerned that it may affect permanence for the child. And I'm sure you know that in most of these cases, a caseworker will get on the stand and say, you know, we really need the permanence that only adoption can provide. That happens in a lot of cases. That didn't happen in this case. So it seems to me that, but that's what the judge was saying.
Correct, and I don't think that's sufficient either. And in fact, it's another one of these errors of logic in a way, because what the court ignored is that those future decisions, if they were in the guardianship context, have to be guided by the same pole star, the same guiding principle that was the most important in this case, which is what? The best interests of the child. And so what the district court essentially said here is, I'm going to find that it's not in the best interests of the child to have the possibility that in the future decisions will be made that are in the best interests of the child. Correct? Because those future decisions, future litigation, what is the standard? There aren't going to be changes in this permanent guardianship unless a district court judge is convinced that it's in the best interest of the child to make those changes. So how can we say now that, oh, we're afraid of that risk? But an additional point, and perhaps an equally important, is, as you point out, it was not supported in the record in this case. In the Court of Appeals cases that have said, yes, we agree, we have to move to termination, and I can point them out for you, all have expert opinion in the record saying we do need the permanence in this case that can only be achieved through termination and adoption.
Mr. Hudson-Pillar, let me ask you this. If we were to agree with you that that part of the trial court's order was defective, the relief is not simply to say you must appoint a permanent guardianship. Isn't the relief simply to let the trial court have another stab at it?
Yes, I would agree with that. The district court has to find all aspects, all of the statutory bases to reach termination. and maybe the district court wants to find more information. I think, though, that this court, on this record, has to conclude that there was a clear, viable placement alternative, less drastic alternative, that was in the child's best interest in this regard. It met the need for a stable, permanent home. Because that's the test. That's what our courts say. They ask that question. Is termination necessary to assure a stable, permanent home? If not, and there's a viable, less drastic alternative, then indeed our cases say it is error to not adopt that less drastic alternative, and such an order should not be affirmed. So that's the question to ask, but Your Honor, I do agree. I think that the court could conclude that in this case, the record does not support the determination made by the trial court and remand it for further proceedings in the district court. I would be arguing at that point that we have a record, and you know, but that's another day. So, and I would urge the court to listen this afternoon, for the answer to that question. You know, was it necessary in this case to terminate parental rights to achieve the stable home that the child was already in and that respondent father was advocating should continue? I point out also, because I think this was one of the fundamental errors made in this case, that is a different analysis with respect to father than with mother. The less drastic alternative analysis is also different because it is a personal right. And I think that was one of the real problems we saw in this case, was a blending of that and a blurring of the evidence in this case. And what we have here is a different circumstance. Mother was afforded an opportunity to work a treatment plan. Father was not. Mother was afforded substance abuse treatment. Father was not and never has been.
Can I ask you on this, on the treatment plan issue, Mr. Hodson-Piller, and again, I'll be candid, and your colleagues over there are going to hear some concerns from me about the treatment plan issue here with father. I've been through the whole record, and there's not a lot there for, I mean, I assume the department proposed this treatment plan, which was, you know, when dad gets out, we'll talk about a treatment plan. Was there any discussion at the hearing or in the adoption of this treatment plan along the lines of this is an EPP case and we have some concerns? I mean, in the abstract, I understand an argument that, you know, dad has no relationship with his child. You know, he gets out of jail when it's, you know, 7-8 months have gone by, and dad hasn't, you know, done nothing. Now, I understand your argument is he wasn't required to do anything. But was there any, just factually, any discussion that this is an EPP case and that this treatment plan is problematic?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. There was a meeting, and it's in the record, a September meeting that's reflected. And for the purposes of father's case, that's a critical meeting because the department knew then that it was very likely that father would be getting out of jail in a matter of weeks, really, months the most, not the several years that was their assumption in July when they sought termination. But the record contains some testimony from case worker Maddox about that. As the court knows, Mr. Maddox, the caseworker, never met or communicated in any way with father, not one time. So even when he learned that information in September, nobody did anything with that. The record just really doesn't contain much on that point.
Thank you.
And with that,
I just have one question. Could you briefly address father's incarceration and the court's ability to make an appropriate treatment plan?
Yes, I think that obviously it's got to be a case-by-case basis, and sometimes incarceration looks different. People may be able to access services that were not available in this case. But frankly, what it makes the less drastic alternative the elegant solution here, the right solution here, because it was going to give the father the chance to demonstrate by his conduct whether he could work a treatment plan or not, to no harm, to no risk whatsoever to the child. So perhaps father's counsel, me, should have paid more attention to the deadline regarding the incarceration. You know, that's about all I think we could have done with the treatment plan at that time. But I think it is a challenge in cases where respondent parents are incarcerated. This one was different because of the short-term nature of that incarceration, which was undisputed. I will reserve the balance of my time, please.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Christopher Ernst for the County of Montrose. I guess I'd like to begin with the second issue that was raised. I think it's the easier issue to address. That is the appropriateness of the treatment plan and whether or not the department had an obligation to do something other than just simply lay out a plan that said, father will get out of jail and then we'll develop a more detailed treatment plan. There was discussion early on about the length of the father's incarceration, and it was anticipated that he would be able to work a treatment plan before the case came to termination. I want to bring the court's attention to the case of People X Rel MS. I didn't cite this in my brief, but it's 129 P3rd 1086, which is directly on point with our case here, where the father objected to a treatment plan at a termination hearing after having accepted the treatment plan when it was proposed at the dispositional hearing. The plan was adopted by agreement, as it was in this case. The father was represented.
What was that? I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Ernst. What was the provisions in the treatment plan in this case? Obviously, we haven't seen it because you didn't cite it, but what were the provisions in that treatment plan?
To summarize, I don't know that I can quote it exactly, but it was very brief. It was basically that the father would obtain his release from incarceration and contact the department and develop a more detailed treatment plan.
Right. And why here should father have even objected? I mean, father's perfectly fine with this treatment plan, which I assume the department drafted. It says, when I get out, I'm going to have a real treatment plan. Father says, that sounds fair to me.
I'm not suggesting that he would have objected at that point. What I'm suggesting that this case says is that when the father realized that his release from incarceration was not forthcoming, that he then had a duty. It was incumbent on him to let his attorney know that, hey, I'm not going to be able to get out of jail by the proposed deadline. I'm not going to be able to do a more substantive treatment plan. We need to go back and ask for a modification of the treatment plan.
But he wasn't required to. That's my concern. I have it. The treatment plan, his action step was, and I'll paraphrase and not to use names, father will contact the MCHHS caseworker when he is released from incarceration. At that time, a visitation plan will be devised for him to see the baby. That was the one that was adopted May 4th. Then there was a treatment plan that doesn't appear to have been adopted, said upon release from incarceration, father will meet with the caseworker to develop a more specific treatment plan. You may all have an understanding of when he's going to get out. There's no deadline listed. Contrary to what I read in your briefs, there's nothing that says he was required to try to get out. And it seems the problem here is the treatment plan was, you know, may have been bad, but I don't think I'm troubled, and I'd like you to respond, persuade me, you know, why you can lay that at father's doorstep. Father relied on a plan adopted by the court that when I'm out, I'll contact the caseworker.
Well, I don't think that suggested it was open-ended, that he could be incarcerated for years and get out and then expect a treatment plan to work.
Tell me what in the treatment plan doesn't make it open-ended. I think, you know, I don't mean to be fighting with you. Persuade me, I'm concerned. It looks pretty open-ended to me.
I don't think you can't find in the treatment plan where it suggests that. The fact that it's an expedited permanency planning case, the fact that there are short deadlines in the case, these things suggest that it's not open-ended, that it's expected he'll start working a plan in a reasonable amount of time. And again, I think that the idea of invited error for him to come now on an appeal and say that this treatment plan wasn't appropriate when he didn't raise an objection at any time during the case prior to the termination hearing, I think that bars that argument now.
Mr. Ernst, is there anything in the record that would show that there was something that father could have done to have speeded his release that he did not do?
No, not that I'm aware of. I think that he was making diligent efforts. He, like anyone that's incarcerated, would prefer not to be incarcerated. So I think that it's, of course, expected that he would do what he could to be released.
This may be an unfair question to you, Mr. Ernst, so if you don't know the answer, that's fine. The record seemed to be undisputed that Dad was due to get out at the latest, like 2 weeks after the termination hearing. Do you know whether that was borne out?
I don't know, Judge. I don't know what his current status is. I don't know where he is or whether he's incarcerated or released. I'm sorry.
Okay, no apology. Thank you.
On the question of lesser alternatives, there are many cases on point. And I think that I'd like to draw the court's attention most to MM, in the interest of MM 726P2D 1108, where the court specifically stated that although the court urges the specificity regarding less drastic alternatives, it's not required. It's once the criteria for termination are met, and I think that it's clear from the record that the required criteria are met for a termination of the parent's rights here, the judges, the court can terminate parents' rights, and there's an assumption that less drastic alternatives have been considered and ruled out. And we don't need to use that presumption in this case because the record shows clearly that the judge did consider those less drastic alternatives.
Judge, since I promised you that I would follow up while you were sitting there, let me ask you two questions I'd like you to address. First, the court did state in its order, citing the statute 19-3702, began the court's discussion by saying the statute expresses a preference for adoption. I have concern about that because I don't think that, I'm not sure that I agree with that statement. I would like you to address whether you think the statute expresses a preference for adoption. And then second, if you would, I'd like you to respond to Mr. Hudson-Piller's assertion that there's no evidence in the record to support that termination was necessary here. As I said, normally the caseworker does get up and give an opinion that adoption is the right way to go. In this case, I did look at the whole record, and there was no such testimony that I saw. So the two questions again are, do you think the statute expresses a preference for adoption versus a permanent guardianship? And second, what evidence in the record was there that adoption was the way to go versus a permanent guardianship?
On the first question, I read the judge's order as you did, and I read the statute looking for that preference in the statute, and I did not see it. I don't agree with the judge that the statute expresses a preference for adoption. But I think that the question of whether adoption versus a permanent placement with a family member, whether or not that's in the child's best interest, is a determination of fact that the trial court here, that ruling should not be disturbed absent a clear finding of error. And I'd like to bring the court's attention to a case cited in Mr. Hudson-Piller's brief, People X Rel TEM, where it says that permanent placement with a family member is dependent on the child's best interest, as is the determination whether to order permanent placement as an alternative to termination. Long-term or permanent placement may not be appropriate when it does not provide adequate permanence or otherwise meet the child's needs. The court clearly found, whether there's a preference in the statute or not, that it's in the child's best interest in this case to order the termination of the parent's rights. Having satisfied, I don't think there's any question that the criteria for termination were met in this case. There's many cases that I could cite and we could go through the record, but I think that it's undisputed that those criteria have been met here, and it really hasn't been argued by Mr. Hudson-Piller that they haven't, just that this less drastic alternative should be considered.
There's no doubt here, is there, that the placement of the child with the family that the child is currently with remains appropriate, was appropriate then, is appropriate now. The only difference is the termination of the rights, correct?
Right.
So the only thing that we would be looking at, correct me if I'm wrong, is whether the actual termination of father or mother's rights here was appropriate, not to the appropriateness of the placement itself, since the child remains in the same location.
Everyone agrees that the placement is appropriate. And it's a unique case, as Mr. Hudson-Piller said, because the placement was at the suggestion of the father. This is a relative of his. And I think that in the record, your question, is there evidence in the record to support termination versus continuing this permanent guardianship? I'd ask you to look at the testimony that the expert called by the father, Dr. Holland. she was asked questions very specifically about this point. What are the potential hazards of a guardianship or a custody order versus adoption? What's the possibility of future litigation interfering with the permanence of the placement of the child with this prospective adoptive family? And her testimony showed that there was a danger to the child, that there was a possibility of disruption to the permanence. And I think that...
Didn't, you know, and again, I'm going from memory here, I don't have it in front of me, but I thought her testimony was, some people say there's this concern, and then she went on at some length and disagreed with that. She, I thought, testified, given that this is a Hispanic family and given the culture, that a termination here would make no sense because that child's going to know dad's the father no matter what the court did. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. You know the record better than I.
You're correct. That was very interesting testimony. She basically said that it doesn't matter what the court does here. The family, being a Hispanic family, is going to do what they're going to do. There's going to be interplay between family members. There's going to be contact between the child and all the various family members. So in essence, she was saying to the court, it doesn't matter, which I thought was, first of all, I thought it was not... fair to the Hispanic culture to sort of generalize in those terms. I think that you need to look at the fact that she never met the father. She's going just on generalizations. And then I would ask you to look at the testimony of the prospective adoptive family, where they testified that they sort of knew this person, the father, that they thought it would be okay if he came around, maybe. I think that the trial court is in the best position to judge the disposition of the witnesses, to read between the lines there and make a determination. Is there a problem here? This is the black sheep in the family. Look at the social history. Look at the criminal record. Look at the history of violence. Look at the drug use. There's no question that the family that was prospectively going to adopt this child would legitimately have concerns about having this person come back into their lives. And the trial court made that determination and said, you know what? No, we're not going to have that. Your rights are terminated. If you want to go around it, your culture allows it, they want to let you in, fine. You can have an ongoing relationship with that child. But if they determine that you're dangerous, as the court did, if they determine that you're unfit, you know, we want permanence for this child. This is an infant who has spent most of his life in this family, doesn't know any other parents. It would be very disruptive and very harmful. So
you're really saying here that the evidence that we had in the record lends itself to some inferences that adoption is the better approach than a permanent guardianship. I think I heard you're agreeing that no one specifically said adoption is the better approach, but there was evidence here like the cousin's concerns about whether dad should come around. I think you're telling us that gives grounds for an inference that adoption is a better approach, and we should defer to the judge. The judge obviously credited that inference. Am I understanding you?
Yes. Okay. And I don't think that it's a reversible error if the judge read into the statute that adoption is preferable, as long as the record supports this conclusion that in this case adoption is preferable.
Mr. Ernst, on that point, if the judge is cranking his discretionary decision about what would provide permanence and what was in the best interest of the child through an incorrect legal perception about the statute favoring one form of adoption over some other form of placement, can we trust the court's exercise of discretion under those circumstances?
Well, I think that if you don't, you'd be reading a lot into one line in a 20-page opinion where the judge expressed what obviously he believes is a better sort of permanence. And if the judge is biased towards adoption versus guardianship, where there's possible disruption to the child, and if he incorrectly led that to the statute, I don't think that's reversible error. I think that's the judge expressing his opinion about what is in the best interest of the child and applying the facts and coming to a conclusion in this case consistent with his own leanings. I don't have much time left, but if Ms. Huffman has anything that she'd like to add, I'd like to give her the balance of my time. Sorry.
It's okay. May it please the court, I'm Julie Huffman, guardian ad litem for the child. I'll just jump right in here at the end and just point out that the judge's final order was very clear that it is critical that this child has consistent, reliable, predictable, and safe care. The child also needs an opportunity to bond with primary caretakers during his infancy in order to be emotionally stable later in life. Respondents have been unable to provide those things for the child. The child would not benefit from continuing a legal relationship with two parents who have half-heartedly, reluctantly, sporadically, and inconsistently pursued reunification recovery, or who acknowledge they are in no position to care for the child. The child deserves to have a permanent resolution. The court has an obligation to provide him with a permanent home.
But why, Ms. Huffman, why does permanent home require adoption versus a permanent guardianship? Let me ask you more specifically, since your time is so limited, what evidence was there that the adoption was a better choice than permanent guardianship?
I think, again, to echo Mr. Ernst's comments, Dr. Holland's testimony, that without a termination and adoption, the potential for disruption for the child is always lingering out there. And I would point to, in the interest of KD, 155 P3rd 634, long-term or permanent placement may not be appropriate when it does not provide adequate permanence or otherwise meet the needs of the child. I believe the judge looked at the needs of the child in this case and decided permanence was more important. In addition, in the interest of DP 181 P3rd 403, permanently placing the child with a family member while allowing the parents to assume some parental responsibilities is not a viable alternative to termination if the child needs a stable, permanent home that can be assured only by adoption, and the judge so found in this case.
Thank you. Very quick points. First, to answer your question, in fact, father was released on November 30th, a week after the termination occurred. He is currently on a drug court probation. Secondly, I want to point out, the court's probably aware of it, but there was an opinion issued April 15th, 2010 by another panel of the court that discusses specifically sufficient findings with respect to less drastic alternatives. I wasn't going to cite it because it's not been, released for official publication. It is in Re AG, April 15th, 2010, and it specifically, in fact, reversed because the court did not make adequate findings with regard to less drastic alternatives. So we can't just operate on a presumption. The district court said it, the judge considered it, and then we're done. There has to be more. And the case of In Re DP, this is February of 2008, 181 P3rd 403. We will hold a trial court's determination as to whether a less drastic alternative exists if that determination is supported by the record. So this is part of the analysis of whether or not termination is appropriate. That has to be a necessary finding. And this court does need to look at the record. And it's ironic that what the folks are relying on is an expert called by the father. And her testimony was very clear that there was bonding going on, there was permanence, and a less drastic alternative made sense and was appropriate, and that the threat of future litigation was not something that she thought was important at all. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. That concludes our docket this afternoon. We'll be in recess.